rules for winning. We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender. Winston Churchill to the House of Commons, Westminster, on the 4th of June, 1940. The big-ticket items in strategy have been covered, but there are other tools that can help in planning our progress at the tactical level, but I will only cover those that I have found in practical terms to be of the most value. It must be remembered that strategy is largely a mental exercise, and that tactics are the means of applying strategy on the ground, in the arena of reality. It is only by winning at the tactical level that we can see a strategy triumph, but this doesn't come easy. As Mike Tyson famously quipped, "Everyone's got a plan until he gets punched in the mouth." A very useful reminder that when the planning is over, the fight to win really begins. Statistics from a few years ago indicated that a new business had a 1 in 10 chance of still being around 5 years later, and after another 5 years, only 1 out of 100 might still be operating. These statistics must be a lot worse after the COVID/climate-engineered downturn, but the stats still indicate that tactics, that the winning of sales every day, every week, and every month are more important than fancy business plans pored over by a bank employee who has never run a company in their life. Unfortunately, running a business looks a lot easier than it is, and the fact that we are more emotionally driven than we like to believe means that ignorance often takes a terrible toll before we wake up to our own folly. When stepping into the roughhouse of the non-corporate marketplace, a fancy suit and Excel spreadsheets won't count for a lot. Businesses tend to be built by tough-minded individuals who learn to survive, and occasionally by the offspring of comfortably off folk who help with advice, funds, and commiserations when things go wrong, and allow raids on their deep pockets to keep things rolling until the L plates can come off. In the businesses that I have run, I have found that a little ditty has helped me along the way, as it pretty much sums things up and keeps you focused on the vital issues that can help you survive. Turnover is vanity, profit is sanity, cash is reality. However, the central banking incompetence, the bureaucrats in our bloated and liberty-light administrative states, and the corporate senior employees in their gold-card-padded jobs have led us down the fast lane to failure. Credentialed cretins are responsible for people revolting all around the world. They held lots of strategy meetings, crisis planning conferences, and national networking shindigs in fancy resorts and hotels. But how did all those chin-wagging sessions work out? Red ink on balance sheets, Meta, Google too, and bodies piling up outside mortuaries as a result of the decisions made in the tiny brains of overpromoted corporals in the political parties. It's clear that they have all been played by darker forces in the power elite and the CCP, the Sun Tzu and von Clausewitz combo, with a dollop of Machiavelli dropped into the mix. Forget computer projections and hockey stick graphs. Take the hard-nosed entrepreneur's approach and base your decisions on good analysis of relevant data. View things through a misty lens, not a rosy one. Adapt as you go along, and you have given yourself half a chance of survival. The coordinated global response to a bug, lockdown, says all you need to know. Don't stick with the plans based on previous experience, isolating the vulnerable. Just toss them out of the window immediately. The plans, not the elderly. Don't consult clampdown. Why? The Japanese had learned to leave decisions to the people, to treat them as adults. The results confirm their wisdom and the retention of their faith in their system. As we know, the hard lessons are the most memorable, so don't forget what the parties did in your country, draw conclusions, and study the hybrid solution. Look at the results it has achieved in a nation with only snow and rock as its main natural resources, then factor in the same resource that we all have left when everything else is lost, the people. There, the people, not the parties, command. The man who really professionalized the general staff and developed other important concepts still used by strategists and tacticians today was the Prussian general Helmuth von Moltke. He was the victor in Prussia's wars in the 1860s and in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-1, which was followed by the unification of Germany under Bismarck, also in 1871. The command and training system that von Moltke had developed made the army so effective that foreign observers could not fathom how his forces were able to defeat opponents so swiftly, wondering whether a secret weapon was behind their success. When he set the wheels in motion to invade France, he was so relaxed that as his forces began implementing his strategy, he settled down for a couple of days to read novels. His confidence was based upon the command concepts that he had developed over the previous decades, and which he had spent many years training his subordinate commanders to understand and use. This system was based upon the commander stating his intent to his subordinates, setting out their objectives and the various constraints within which they could operate, but never telling them how to achieve their aims. They could then use their own judgment, training, and experience as to how to deliver the results he sought. This freedom ensured that the troops in contact with the enemy could adapt their tactical plans according to the actual situation they faced, not that of some paper scenario sketched out in a conference room a few days before. Von Moltke had thoroughly trained his army in his methods, and they had trialed and proven them in victories against the Danes and the Austrians before defeating the French. I have studied many classics and great compendiums on strategy, but if I only had one work to offer, it would not be Sun Tzu, Machiavelli, von Clausewitz, Liddell Hart, or Lawrence Friedman. It would be The Art of Action by Stephen Bungay. Bungay, 2011. This is a book by a business consultant and respected historian, and he focuses on the Prussian system, its development and practical application, often through the prism of business. Nevertheless, this adds to the mix, and he offers a depth of analysis on the realities of strategy, tactics, and leadership that is difficult to find in other works. It has provided much of the material I have used in my discussions concerning strategy in this volume. Bungay brings out the importance of initiative in the Prussian system, and this is crucial for our futures, for freedom, in the new democracies, and for the better place we are heading towards. Interestingly, von Moltke's concepts are the opposite of those of the rigid Prussian school system, which had been analyzed and adopted as the model for the U.S. public school system in 1852, but more on this disastrous choice, a deliberate one, later. Einstein detested the German schools he attended, he rebelled against the Prussian regimentation, and renounced his citizenship at the first opportunity. He went on to attend Swiss schools and institutes which he loved. Freedom under a hybrid system can do that to you. In von Moltke's system, as well as making clear the unit's aim, the objectives of those commands two levels up were also given. This ensured that all commanders could go beyond their basic task if an opportunity arose to help achieve even greater success. All soldiers and officers at every level were told that if an opportunity arose and there were no senior personnel around to authorize their actions, they must use their initiative and take the appropriate action. This ensured that once they had been fully briefed, they could focus on the simple intentions of the commander without needing further orders from above. This allowed even very low-ranked soldiers to exploit unexpected opportunities without worrying about being punished. In fact, von Moltke believed in reprimanding those who did not exploit openings because they feared doing something that they had not been ordered to do. He had learned that initiative was the key, the force multiplier that must be unleashed, at every level to ensure that the full force of his army would be felt by his opponent throughout any engagement. This is the secret weapon that had been identified but not understood by those watching the remarkable successes of the Prussians. Activists supporting the hybrid system should now have some idea about the system and know what their aim is, so they can use their own initiative at the local level to put pressure on bloated bureaucrats to achieve it. You know your own patch better than any outsider, so identify the weaknesses in the hollowed-out system that you face and then use your resources to target those weak points. Build local alliances with like-minded people and groups so that you can combine your forces where they can have the most effect. Plan, but more importantly, act. Even a quick plan will help, and when one thing doesn't work, try something else. This is not an academic exercise, as it's about taking power from the arrogant few and handing it over to the grounded many. Every act will bring you useful experience, and immediately after each action, get together and talk about what you learned to ensure that lessons are captured and errors are avoided in the future. In this way, greater successes can be built upon the experience. Think about the areas of incompetence that were described earlier and take them into account when planning any move. Keep it peaceful, but back the opposition into a metaphorical corner and see how they behave under pressure. We own this land as our families fought for it, and they didn't do that for us to gift it to a few fine-eggling blowhards. We must identify the most effective opponents and target them first. Why are they so anti-democracy? What is motivating them? The hybrid is a great solution to our problems. It's the way forward. So what's in it for them to oppose it? Ask them, pressure them to get on board, and remind them that history will be their judge. Taking the initiative is vital, but linked to it is a favorite acronym of the military instructors. These are the good old 7 PS, the everyman tool that pays off in every situation. Prior preparation and planning prevents piss poor performance. This covers everything from a nation preparing for conflict by building Spitfires to humble the Luftwaffe, or an activist planning to confront a controlling party in a meeting at the local council. For the latter, study the council's procedures with regards to using the tools of direct democracy, and if they don't offer them, ask why not. If they do, research to find out if they are used, and if they have been, what for and when, and look at the successes and failures of the petitioners. Kipling's guidance can help, though many supposed investigative reporters seem to be unaware of it. I keep 6 honest serving men. They taught me all I knew. Their names are what and why and when, and how and where and who. When you have gathered the data and spoken to other people willing to support you in your mission, prepare to go to a council meeting and demand action. Maybe some independent councillors will join you and help. Don't expect anything from the major parties. They will not be supportive, no matter how successful Switzerland is in using the tools. In fact, precisely for that reason. However, don't let up, and also keep the pressure on the independents to join you. Work with the local media to get coverage and stage events in town to inform and inspire local people that there is a way out of this mess. Remember, you are not politicians and you do not represent a political party. These are universally disliked, but you are the antidote to them, not one of them. They are the problem and you are the solution. We all are. After the 7 PS, we come to the 3 BE, an old army saying, bullshit baffles brains. Unfortunately, this is a lot easier to do than we imagine, and is one of the most successful devices used on us by the elites and their minions. The PR and advertising industries, the marketing teams and the slick salespeople are all 3BB operators, and who owns them or employs them? They are hyping up what the owners and their clients want hyped, followed by any useful material to support the general narrative. The bullshitters can turn their message on a dime, just as a good barrister can argue for or against the accused and win either way. The 3 BE work well in many, if not most, cases, but this tool will only be deployed when it is deemed appropriate. Their first option is to avoid dealing with anything that negatively touches upon or questions the narrative, basically omit rather than admit. Then, if something has to be addressed, damn with faint praise and move on swiftly. Finally, any argument that can possibly undermine the power elite, that logically and credibly calls into question their position and the narratives they have pushed for decades, then these dangerous ideas must be quashed and, if necessary, commonly so today, their bearers crushed. So, beware. As Churchill said to a young Quentin Hogg, who would go on to be a government minister, "If you can speak in this country, you can do anything." Cooper, 2022, PR 60. You can guarantee that whenever required, the three B's will be deployed to baffle, distract, and demean troublesome messengers. No wisdom of the crowds wanted here. George Orwell is known for cutting through the lies and the deliberate misuse of language by those seeking to control us, most famously in his fictions 1984 and Animal Farm. In addition, he wrote a less widely read but brilliant short essay on the abuse of language for political purposes, and it is a must-read for those fighting for freedom in the former democracies, a couple of quid off any online store. Politics and the English Language, Orwell, 2013, was written to defend the use of clear English and to highlight the methods used by those trying to hide the truth of totalitarian crimes and statist suppression. Clarity is avoided in favor of words that cloak reality, tiptoeing around the subject or making assertions without evidence to support them. For example, they can reduce deliberate famines, killing millions, to a local issue with food supplies. The New York Times is famous for this, the paper of choice for the gilded elite and the Wall Street lawyers who rotate between the government, corporate corner offices, and the agencies. Walter Duranty is one of the most famous of the dissemblers they have employed, a man who ensured that Stalin's eradication of the kulaks in the Ukrainian winter of 1931 to 1932 was minimized so effectively that FDR recognized the Soviet Union immediately after the NKVD-managed genocide ended. One of the British left-wing journalists based in Moscow at the time turned away from support for Russia to become a leading and respected commentator and public intellectual, and he had something to say about Duranty. Malcolm Muggeridge had written an expose of the famine, which Duranty claimed did not happen. So not surprisingly, Muggeridge called Stalin's favorite foreign journo the greatest liar of any journalist I have ever met. Radosh, Ronald Radosh, Alice, 2005, pp. 612. Oh, and Duranty was lauded as a guest of honor alongside the Soviets at the U.S. event that heralded the new agreement. Less than a decade later, Stalin signed his pact with Hitler, which led to World War II. FDR then cozied up to Uncle Joe in preference to Churchill, hardly the best judge of character. Today, Trump is fair game for the political activists in the press, even after several extensive investigations turned up nothing. However, Hunter's laptop? Hardly a word. Maybe a derogatory remark about the shop guy who handed it in, then silence. Maybe because the FBI advised Facebook that it is unmentionable, but nothing in writing, of course. Oh no, forget that. Charge the repair guy. Whatever happens, they will keep awarding themselves prizes and taking big, fat paychecks. Most corporal collators that I worked with could do a better job. One thing that I noticed at Sandhurst was that those who could write well did much better in the overall standings than their performance in the field often warranted, something no doubt reflected in most endeavors. This in some way reflects the value of the triple B device, but it is important that arguments are clearly stated and understood, and writing is obviously central to this. Orwell's essay contained his six rules for writing, and it is worth buying just to see the examples he used to show how he arrived at them. However, there is an even simpler and more easily recalled idea that I heard at some time in the dim and distant past, I think in the military, these are the ABCs of communication, and they refer to accuracy, brevity, and clarity. So, when preparing any material that you will be making public, remember this simple rule. Accuracy is vital in ensuring that what you say is true, as far as that exalted idea can be matched. Brevity, to keep it only as lengthy as is needed to state exactly what you want to say, and clarity, to ensure that it reads logically and can be understood without difficulty. Doing this will not only focus your thinking on those reading your work, it will also help ensure that you are expressing it as effectively as it possibly can be. You will not find this taught on PR courses. For me, writing should really be termed rewriting, as it is through the constant revision of a sentence, a paragraph, and a chapter that an article or a book takes form. This polishing process is vital to getting things right, so I just get my thoughts down and then begin the work. I can go over something dozens of times before I am happy with it, but English never interested me at school, so I still have a lot to learn. Whatever the case, practice is worth the effort, as not only does the finished product read better, you are honing your thinking skills and thus your entire future each time you sit down to hit the keys. There certainly is a lot of wisdom in the saying that I heard at Sandhurst that the pen is mightier than the sword. This truism is probably best captured in the journalist Edward R. Murrow's assessment of Churchill's wartime oratory that he mobilized the English language and sent it into battle. He also said something about never giving up, and as our freedoms are salami sliced and discarded, we must remember that, in a police state, the pen can be even more lethal than the sword. Carr, 2004, p. 21. In my early days in the army, I received some useful advice that showed me that I was not going to match Winston's mobilizing ability. I had sent a report to a boss I respected, and he called me to let me know that it contained errors, specifically making the point that I had signed it. He stated that if I signed it, I owned it, and would be judged accordingly, and not only on my writing. Slapdash communications indicates something about the possibly chaotic thinking processes of the sender, so I advise pausing before hitting the send key, maybe a night's rest before doing so, and checking it once more. Certainly, that gentle guidance helped me, and not only with my written work. Having said all that, I know very successful entrepreneurs who can hardly write a sentence, but they are exceptional doers and don't much concern themselves with scribbling.